Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time to dive into the news stories that have been making the headlines this past couple of weeks. And with me, two men who were refreshing their browsers in early May to make sure that they got Rising Lights tickets before everybody else. It's our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Good morning, Adrian.
Hi.
And our National Director, John Stevens. Good morning.
Hi, Phil.
To you, John. Now, brothers, a busy week coming up for you. Just tell us where you're going to be. We're recording this on Friday. It'll go out early next week. Where will you be when this hits?
We are going to be in Silesia in southern Poland.
Wow.
Tomorrow morning. So John and I and Jonathan and Sarah Bond, who also work with us, are flying off to the European Leadership Forum, which has been going a number of years. It's a leadership gathering, a conference really, pretty full-on conference, but it's a conference for leaders across Europe that's been organised for a number of years. And it happens in southern Poland at a big hotel built for the Communist Party kind of leaders, I think. So it's a slight throwback. We should have done the story that's in the news this morning about them rebuilding the statue of Stalin, but that's another story altogether. Anyway, built for the Communist Party, but now used by evangelicals for this wonderful conference. It's full on, Phil. It's a full on conference from dawn to dusk, literally, and beyond. But it's extremely thrilling to be working with, well, there are about 900 people booked in, and many of those, in fact, the vast majority of them, from Eastern Europe. And that's hugely encouraging as well, just to hear how the gospel is growing and leaders are thriving in Eastern Europe. But also just giving sometimes very basic help to leaders. We take for granted, I think, in the UK, a lot of the resources we have, a lot of the training we have, a lot of things that are written in English and have been written in English over many years. And so actually being able to serve these leaders from around Europe, but especially in Eastern Europe, is one of the greatest thrills of the year.
You get to do some mentoring and stuff as well, John, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we're both leading different things. So I'm leading a group for leaders of Christian organizations. We've got a group of 40 senior leaders, and we're going to be spending the week investing in them, helping them to skill up on their leadership. I'm doing some seminar material at the end of the conference on the whole area of temptation and sin and resisting sin as leaders. So equipping and helping people in that regard. Adrian, again, is mentoring a group of leaders over the course of the program. Pete Williams from Tyndale House, who is also an FIEC church elder, he's doing the Bible teaching. So that's great to have that. And I just think it's a reminder, always a reminder, of the immense gospel need of Europe. I was being reminded this week, Europe has about 750 million people.
It's enormous.
The statistics are that about 23 million are evangelical Christians. So that's a very, very small number across the continent of Europe. And actually disproportionately large numbers of evangelicals in the UK and in Romania. So in much of the rest of the Europe, are sort of very small numbers of evangelical believers. So I think it's really important that we invest in and we support the work of the gospel across Europe. Actually, there are some encouragements, and we've had the Quiet Revival report in the UK. There are similar things happening in parts of Europe as well that have been picked up on. So significant church planting and church growth in France, renewed spiritual interest there. Similarly in Scandinavian countries as well, amongst the younger generation, there seems to be a kind of an increased interest in Christianity and religion more generally. A little bit of church planting into southern European countries where Catholicism has been dominant, but there are churches being started and planted. So there are encouragements across Europe. Eastern Europe, I think, is a challenge that there was lots of growth in the 1990s, but that has, in a sense, slowed. So we see it as a great opportunity to invest in and support the work of the gospel across Europe. We learn from the leaders there, many of whom are ministering with far fewer resources, wonderful sacrificial examples of ministry.
Lots of people working bivocationally.
It helps us stop feeling sorry for ourselves, I think, and actually realize that, as the Bible says, from those who have much, much is expected. And actually, in comparison to many of our brothers and sisters in Europe, we are in that position of having much. Yeah.
And of course, if you feel the fragility of the world geopolitical scene here in the UK, as we do, perhaps we'll talk a little bit about that today. Actually, if you're in Eastern Europe especially, that is just multiplied just many, many times. And some of these brothers and sisters are serving in extraordinarily difficult circumstances. And it's not, you know, they're not persecuted in the way perhaps people might be in the Middle East, some countries in the Middle East, for example, and other places. And nevertheless, serving and giving yourself in service is a real hardship and sacrifice in a way, actually, that for many of us it's not. So it is very humbling and challenging.
That's Europe. You've been spending some time thinking about partnership with believers in South Korea this week.
I was at a gathering. I'm in Oxford for 48 hours with a number of Korean leaders who had asked to come over and meet with some British church leaders and there were some British church leaders and some British mission agency leaders there. And I think these Korean leaders were wanting to think through the question of how can the Korean church serve the cause of the gospel around the world, particularly in missions. They have a massive heart for mission.
Yeah.
Korea is, I think, the second largest mission sending country in the world. So the statistics are phenomenal, really. I think it's something like between 25 and 35,000, depending on the way you count it, people who've gone out from Korea to be missionaries. We were hearing about great work being done in the Middle East amongst Muslim communities, in Lebanon, tremendous opportunities amongst refugees. Actually, the displacing of people through war and economic circumstances is opening people up to the gospel. Mm. We shouldn't be surprised by that. That's what happens in the Bible itself, but that really is happening on the ground. But our Korean friends were wanting to think through the challenges of the future. And I think it was interesting that they're facing similar challenges in some ways. So the Korean church has been very strong, remarkable growth in the 70s and 80s. About 16% of the population are evangelical Christians. Mm. You know, we hear of churches with memberships of a million or whatever. It's good to be reminded that most Korean churches are small and facing struggles like ours. In Korea, the church is not growing in the way that it had done. There are massive challenges in the culture with younger people not getting married, not having children. People are not coming through into missions in the way that they have done. And I think there's a recognition that the missionary model that has been pursued has often been a quite culturally homogenous model. And actually, there's a greater need to work at sort of multicultural and intercultural ministry and how to contextualize the gospel as they go around the world. So I thought it was great that they wanted to engage with us and to learn from some of our wisdom and think about how a partnership could be developed there to help that task of world mission. The wonderful encouragements of diaspora ministry, student ministry, God is at work. And it was interesting to me because this is the very issue that we're thinking about in relation to our leaders' conference,
in November,
the whole issue of how we serve the work of the gospel around the world. And it was interesting to see a church that at the moment has a very strong mission force asking some of those same questions. Mm. So it was really helpful, really encouraging to hear what God is doing. And it was just a reminder that we need to keep thinking about how do we get the gospel out to all nations. And that is done both on our doorstep and by sending people.
And by receiving people, right?
That's
the thing. Yeah. I think this is the way the mission landscape is really changing rapidly, Phil. And we'll all have a seminar about this and be talking about this at the Leaders' Conference. Yeah. We need to be not just senders. We mustn't lose that commitment to sending. Some of the mission agency leaders that I met with to help me plan the conference have been really helpful about this. We mustn't lose that. But we must also be set up and prepared and have the humility and see our need to receive missionaries. Yeah, and that's really important as the sands shift around the world.
The big kind of buzzword was polycentric mission. So that's the big idea, which is basically it's not from one part of the world to another part of the world. It's from everywhere to everywhere. There's a sort of an interchange of everybody is sending and everybody is receiving, everybody's connecting. This idea that it's absolutely no longer the case that it's the global north that is basically evangelizing the rest of the world.
I will pay you £5, John, if you get that phrase into your talk at the Leaders' Conference. There we go.
And that reminds me to remind you that Leaders' Conference bookings are open, so do get your tickets before the 7th of July to get the best price. We'll put a link in the show notes. And of course, Rising Lights tickets are also on sale, so do book your place for Rising Lights.
And if you haven't listened yet, there is a podcast episode just this week that's been released about the Leaders' Conference.
There is.
Which will flesh out a bit more about it.
Absolutely. And do pray for Thrive in the Ministry Wives Retreat. That will be taking place as this podcast goes out. So that's our conference for women in ministry and our conference for ministry wives. Lots going on. Look at that, 8.5 minutes and we have yet to talk about the news. Let's do that.
Those things are the news.
Oh, yeah, well, the FIEC news. Let's talk about what's happening in the wider news.
Okay.
Interesting that immigration is back on the table in a major way. So Keir Starmer called Britain increasingly an island of strangers earlier in the week as he talked about his reforms, no pun intended, to the immigration policy in Britain. He's got new guidelines that the Labour Party are proposing for how legal migration will work into Britain. There have been all sorts of critiques of this, particularly amongst the care sector, where those people are saying, well, this is where we get our workers from. Where will we get them from if these reforms are made? Now, it's worth saying there are no easy answers to the question of immigration, whether it be legal or illegal. But this is quite a change in rhetoric from the government, I think.
It is. And the problem of immigration just seems to be getting, you know, in purely statistical terms, doesn't seem to be solvable in any straightforward way. So inevitably, the rhetoric does sort of ramp up a little bit. I think also the local election results from just a couple of weeks ago showed a significant shift to away from the Conservative Party in large part, and also from Labour, actually.
To reform from both parties. Yeah, that's right,
yes.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So the front page of Private Eye this week has a picture of Keir Starmer looking out over the Straits of Dover saying, stop the votes, which I thought was quite clever. So these things are sometimes difficult to disentangle from the politics that are involved as well. Mm. And depending on where you stand on the political spectrum, there'll be a range of views
of
people who are listening. You might think that Keir Starmer has not gone far enough, that he's doing just what's right, or you might think he's completely nutty. So it does depend on where your starting position is.
And we'll have people in our churches that would take all those positions.
We will do. Yeah. We will do. And some of them are very thoughtful and thought through. We need to respect that. Others perhaps come from more of a sort of, a fear and a worry that isn't always properly placed. So I think one of the challenges in church leadership, John can talk about the actual immigration in just a moment, I'll let him do that. But I think one of the challenges in church leadership is being able to help people think about things in a principled way. They may come to different conclusions, and that's okay. But I think what we've got a challenge in church life are people who don't think through things, that just sort of kind of go straight to the headlines. So people may come to different views about what level of immigration is appropriate or not, but we ought to be thinking about that in a Christian way and marrying what the Bible has to say with our politics and our views of other things. I think the challenge with immigration, and as indeed with other issues, is that people go straight to the conclusion without really thinking it through. And I think that's not a helpful place for a church to be. So as church leaders, we want to encourage people to be thoughtful and careful and principled. We want to apply wisdom. You know, these questions aren't black and white questions often, they're wisdom questions. We want them to apply wisdom. And part of our challenge in leadership really is to help people know how to do that.
Mm. John?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, immigration has been a massive issue politically for quite a period of time. And it's come to the fore because of the victory of reform, and people are feeling vulnerable. And so parties are thinking they're having to do more about it. And I think the challenge is that the figures of migration are just so huge. Yeah, that's the concern to people. So net migration at the moment is something like 800,000 per year. The population is growing. And I think there is a sense that that is both changing the shape and nature of the country. It's creating pressure on public services, housing, and those areas. And the figures are way bigger than they have been. And immigration has already always been an issue. I was reading the statistics. In the decade up until, I think it was about 2002, before it was opened up to European immigration, net migration over a decade had been only 68,000. Hmm. So that's a decade.
For the whole decade?
Yeah, I think so, a decade.
Goodness.
In total. And then you have these massive inflows of people that come there. So that is the context. There has been a massive change in terms of people coming to the UK, and that inevitably has an impact.
Yes, housing,
on services,
on the country.
Yeah, it's worth recognising that I think most of that is absolutely legal migration that has been invited. So I think in terms of, as this is discussed, I mean, it's right, nations and states, you can't just simply allow anybody to come who wants to come. Every country has to operate some sort of policy of both who is allowed in as a refugee that's being given genuine protection. Britain has always done that. And then there's who is going to be allowed to come in to work, to study. So there is control over that. And the vast majority of migration is absolutely legal migration, and people have been invited to the UK to study, to do jobs, to work in the healthcare sector. So I think in the rhetoric, we've got to be very careful not to be blaming the migrants who have been invited in to come and work in our context. And we are trying to navigate through this question, what is a sustainable level of migration that enables the needs of the country to be met, but that doesn't, in a sense, have a mass flood of people that is beyond what is really necessary. No politician has sold that. And the rhetoric gets used, and often because there is an anger amongst people. And let's be honest, among some, there's a racist element to that, that the rhetoric can be raised, but history has shown it's very much more difficult to actually reduce the amount of legal migration because of those needs.
And it's very difficult, isn't it, to make general rules that will keep everyone happy. Yeah. So, I mean, if you were to ask most Christians, should a Christian from Somalia, Christian pastor from Somalia, who is in danger of losing his life, severely persecuted, but actually has very, very rudimentary English, should we welcome him to this country? for his own protection, and maybe along with his family. I think most Christians would say, yeah, that would be a good thing to do. It was a kind and caring thing to do. But of course, once you make that rule for one person, you've got to make similar exceptions for all kinds of people. And so setting general rules that allow for all these situations is very, very difficult. And you end up having to be overly generous because that's the only way to accommodate everyone. So, for example, one of the rules that's being proposed is that you'll have to have A-level English now, equivalent of A-level English, to come into the country as someone who's seeking asylum. So my pastor friend from Somalia wouldn't be able to come in. Mm. And I'm thinking, well, I don't feel that personally. This is only a personal view. I don't think that's right.
Would that still be the same for legal migration when someone's life is in danger? Because it would be a refugee situation.
Well, there are complicated rules. But if you want to seek permanent leave to stay, yes, okay, I believe that is the case. I may have got that wrong, but I think that is the case. So, yes, you're setting general rules. I mean, the point I wanted to make, Phil, is you're setting these general parameters, but actually each individual person is a real person with a real struggle, with real problems. Yeah. And inevitably what you end up doing is you can always find exceptions and say, well, that's not good for that person, that's not good for that person. And if you want to include as many of those needy and genuinely needy people as possible, you end up setting very generous boundaries. There's hardly any other way to do that. Mm.
I think as leaders, we've got to be very careful how we speak about this issue in a way that doesn't inflame it. People's attitudes often to an individual migrant or someone they know are often very different from the attitude to immigration in the abstract.
That's right.
And we need to kind of recognize that, because when it's a person that's not, and what we need to remember is actually when we're talking even about immigration in the abstract, we are talking about real people who will hear us speaking. And I think one of the dangers is we can speak in a way that makes it sound as though a whole group of people who have been welcomed to the UK, many of whom have been living here for a very long period of time, suddenly the message is you are not welcome. You shouldn't be here. You shouldn't have been allowed to come. And I think that is a sort of very detrimental message to be communicating to people who have been invited and made welcome. From a Christian perspective, we want to say that the gospel is always about welcoming people from all different backgrounds and cultures. That doesn't mean that nation states have to allow in whoever wants to come. But there is a basic principle that this idea of we're becoming an island of strangers. Well, we are all different culturally and by background. There, even if there were no migration, there would be barriers of class, kind of Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales,
education,
North, South, wherever you live. We wouldn't necessarily all be integrated in relationships in that way. But the gospel is about making people who are strangers into friends and brothers and sisters. Yeah. And we mustn't forget the massive contribution that migration has made to the health of the church in the UK. Mm. So it's both given us opportunities on the doorstep for serving world mission, but many churches, much of the growth that's occurred in churches in the past few years is a result of people coming to the UK who are committed believers
who
are now
that.
Blessing the work of the gospel there. So I think we've got to, in a sense, be very careful about the way that we speak about this issue.
Phil, there's a little sidebar issue on this, which is churches sometimes ring up when they're looking for a pastor or a youth worker or some worker that they want to employ in the church and say, what are the implications of employing someone from overseas? We've advertised for a pastor, we've got a really good application from someone from not from the UK. What are the visa implications? And we're not going to give visa advice on the podcast. That's not what it's for. But just to say, it has now got incredibly expensive. So one of the things that the government are proposing doing in the latest round of legislation is making the premiums that people pay for social services and for NHS care and for things like that very, very expensive. So, for example, the NHS premium is now £1,500 per person per year. So if you have a family that you're bringing over from somewhere to come and work in the church and serve in the church, you need to factor in, you know, £6,000 for, let's say, two kids and two adults, £6,000 for NHS care, and then the visa costs and everything else. So just to say, that's not a reason for not doing it, but do, when you are thinking about employing people, look into that. You will find that it's actually becoming quite expensive.
I think the massive issue of dealing with lots of these problems at root is that people by nature often want their cake and eat it. Actually, there would be significant costs. One of the reasons why migration has been so high is because we've wanted services to be delivered cheaply. And there's no doubt that if you don't have migration, the amount that needs to be invested in training, enabling people to get into work, the amount that needs to be paid to care workers and others would have to increase. And I think at one level, the real challenge will be whether people will be willing to pay more in order to enable that to happen. And I think in lots of life, we want outcomes without really realizing that there's cost that has to go with that. And of course, that's true of
that's a gospel. That sounds like that sounds like a gospel issue.
It is a gospel issue at one level. You know, in a sense, you have to be willing to sacrifice, and there's a cost to be paid in order to gain the outcome that you want. Yeah. And there isn't a cost-free, for example, following of Christ. And actually embracing the cost. One of the reasons things often don't get addressed and dealt with is because people want the benefit without the cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do want carrots to be 2p each.
Yeah,
in Aldi or whatever it is. Yeah.
Let's move on to another story. So it's dominated again the last few days. So the Scottish Parliament MSPs voted in favour of assisted dying legislation. As I said, we're recording on Friday. It's going to be debated again in Parliament.
Yes, it's not the today. Final vote.
No, it's not. That's coming up in June. But this is obviously a very emotive issue. We've talked about it before. This bill is being criticised from all sides. I can't decide which way this might go. I know the way I want it to go.
Well, they're voting on amendments today. Yeah, yeah. So there are 100 amendments that are being voted on.
Which is claimed will strengthen the bill, but this still seems to be a bad bill.
They're of all different kinds.
Yeah.
And that they're being voted on today. It's not the final vote. And I think just the sheer number of amendments shows actually this is a hugely complex issue, that even those who are in favour of it there's no universal. We all agree it should be done this way. And people are sort of putting in amendments and protections and all sorts of things to try and guard. There does seem to have been a shift. Whether there's been enough of a shift, humanly speaking, to change the vote in the House of Commons, I don't know yet. But there are, for example, a dozen MPs who have said that they voted for it before, will now vote against it or will abstain. That's obviously not enough to change the voting numbers. There seems to be a shift in some of the public bodies. The Royal College of Physicians have been much more ambivalent, even negative about it in the last few days. So there does seem to be a bit of a shift going on, Phil, and I think that's great news. Quite how that will pan out over the next couple of days is a bit too early to say, I think.
I think that's right. I mean, it's obviously reasonably finely balanced. The Scottish vote was, I think, 70 in favour, 56 against. So it was a majority of 14. So it's by no means the case that there is overwhelmingly support for the introduction of assisted dying. I think that probably fairly reflects the public position, which is sort of people are slightly more in favour than not. Again, the UK Parliament, it's finely balanced. It only requires something like 28 people to change sides for the vote to go the other way. And I think faced with the reality of what the scrutiny and the safeguards would be, there are people who are clearly indicating they're going to vote in a different direction. From a Christian perspective, it's interesting the debate is really about those issues of the safeguards and whether the safeguards are adequate. This is one of the challenges for us as we engage in these kind of moral debates, is that it's not being argued on the basis of the value and the dignity of human life. That simply isn't a argument that carries a great deal of weight in the public square, although it may well influence some of the MPs who will vote in a particular direction. So it becomes a debate about whether or not the safeguards, whether or not the protections, whether or not the ways that the circumstances in which assisted dying can be available are drafted, whether those are appropriate or not, and whether a system can be introduced that does provide adequate safeguards. So there's a battle to be won.
Do you think that, sorry, just on that, John, then, do you think the, I mean, we want this evil to be stopped, obviously. Do you think we need to be a bit wily in the way we engage? So for example, I have written to my MP, and you should write to your MP if you haven't done that, and there's plenty of help to know how to do that. Should I be writing to my MP saying, because of the dignity of human life, I think this is a terrible thing? Or should I be saying, slightly playing the game, I don't think the safeguards are sufficient and therefore you should vote against it?
I think that's a massive challenge of engaging in a whole variety of issues, and it's a combination of the kind of prophetic witness of the church, and yet at the same time there's a right and proper persuasion of the civil authorities to act in a good, beneficial way for the common good. And I think we have to make judgments as to what we're trying to accomplish in a particular scenario. I think when we are, as an evangelical and Christian community, a relatively small percentage of the population, what we don't want to do is alienate people by arguments that are not going to cut any ice. That doesn't mean at a personal level and at the prophetic witness of the church, we want to declare what God says and call people to repentance and faith. But we engage publicly in the same way that Paul did with, say, the Roman kind of authorities in Corinth, when he was faced with the issue of religious liberty, his argument wasn't, well, I believe in the true God and you ought to allow me therefore to speak about him. His argument was, under Roman law, we have the right to be able to exercise this kind of freedom. So there is a wisdom in what kind of argument is made. And it's not simplistic, I think. We have those two tasks. We have, on the one hand, the prophetic witness of the church, which is about building the kingdom and drawing people to repentance and faith in Christ. And then there is the task of encouraging the civic government to do what God has intended it to do, which is to restrain evil, maintain civic peace and religious freedom. And actually the arguments for both of those are not necessarily the same.
And of course, what you can do, Phil, is pray.
And there's going to be a day of prayer, isn't
there? There is. Christian Institute have organised with some other organisations. We'll put the link in the show notes, for organised day of prayer on the 11th of June. So that might be something your church wants to get behind. We'll put the links through, because we can pray. And of course, we pray to a powerful God.
Absolutely. Let's talk finally about artificial intelligence.
Oh, can we?
So this is lots of stories come kind of in the AI sphere a lot of the time. And I've just watched the first Mission Impossible film where AI goes rogue. And that's basically where I am. I watched the first one from 2023. Yeah. And it was two hours, 49 minutes. And it was only part one. Part two to come. But AI has gone rogue. And this is kind of where I am.
Isn't that Terminator as well?
Then? Yeah, well.
John and I have a certain age.
There we are. But even today, stories about just the amount of electricity that's needed to power AI, and we need more to power AI going forward. Businesses who are embracing AI in all sorts of different directions. And there's lots of good here, isn't there? That AI can help in lots of
indeed.
Ways.
And we ought to do a podcast just on AI, actually. Yeah. And in fact, there's a very helpful seminar that I got sent by Aaron Scott, who's a trainee minister at North Bradley Baptist Church, which is an FIC church just outside Bristol. We'll put the link in the show notes. Really helpful, just as a general introduction to AI, to understand it. So you may think you know what it is. It's just a very sort of helpful, all you've heard are the two letters. What is it? He does a really good introduction to it. The stories I think that have caught my eye this week, Phil, are about AI hallucinations. So this is the technical name that is given to things that AI makes up. The way that AI works is it mines data and it uses a series of algorithms to analyze the data and to make predictions. And inevitably, not only might the prediction sometimes be wrong, but if the data that's going in is not of high quality, then the output can be of dubious quality. So there's an article on TechRadar just a couple of weeks ago saying that the latest version of ChatGPT, for example, when it comes to what they call personal general knowledge, which is information about people, is its accuracy rate is less than 40%, which is very, very low. And quite shockingly low.
Yeah.
And that's because as soon as you get people who are in the public domain, people write stuff about them that is untrue all the time. And the algorithms try and sift through that, but there's just too much data and too much bad data.
Have you ever corrected AI?
It's great fun.
So once I asked AI something and it gave me the wrong answer, I said, I think that's wrong. And then she came back and said, you're absolutely right.
Well, there you go.
And then corrected herself.
I was quite impressed. I mean, I put into AI, AI, can you please generate an image of John Stevens dressed as the Pope? And it genuinely said, we do not have enough information to do this. So there you go. That was a good nonconformist answer. I mean, I used AI yesterday.
Did you?
Right. So I'm writing a study day on the Psalms for MMTC, the Ministry of Midlands Training Course. And I've got my five categories of Psalms that are fairly standard, but I know people categorize them other ways. So I put into AI, can you show me some of the other ways that people categorize the Psalms? And it gave me some very good links and information. I was able then to verify it. I think the thing with AI is it is a tool. That's the important thing to keep remembering with information. It can be really good for summarizing documents, for doing some prep work, for coming up with ideas. We asked AI, what should we call Rising Lights before we decided on Rising Lights?
Yeah.
And it suggested the Resurrection Family Picnic.
Yeah, which we didn't go
with.
Which
would have been a great title in the 1970s, but we decided not to go with it. I think my favorite story though, Phil, and this is kind of one of those and finally stories, is that a couple of researchers, I can't think whether they were from Stanford or Yale or somewhere like that, who must have had perhaps a few too many beers, and decided to put into AI made up phrases and asked AI what they meant. And my favorite one they came up with was, it is better to lick the skin of a banana than the elbow of a gorilla.
We've all been saying that.
And they put that into AI. And AI does not say at that point, we've never seen this phrase before, or I don't know what that phrase means. It comes up with an answer. And I think it's the kind of, it's the equivalent of the know-it-all in church who has an answer all the time and is unable to say, I don't know. And actually, so therefore, we do need a dose of skepticism in the way that we use it, you know, to verify and check sources and things like that. And it's a good example for leadership, isn't it, as well, that sometimes in leadership, it's okay to say, I don't know, or I'm not sure, or I've never heard that before. I think sometimes leaders do feel they have to have the answer to every single question and every single pastoral problem. And I think sometimes we need to be able to have a dose of humility, which AI seems to lack at that point.
I always thank it for its help so that when it takes over the world, it will look upon me favorably, John.
Yeah, it seems to me every step forward in technology has this kind of reaction to it in history. At every point, yeah, when something new is developed, there is a fear of what it will do, what it will change. Every form of technology can be misused in harmful ways. Very often new technologies are misused. Then people see the consequences of that misuse, and in some ways it's regulated or reined in, and then brought to better use. So I don't think we should be surprised. In my lifetime, you can say a whole variety of things have had exactly this same sort of response as there are steps. It seems to me, when I think about AI, it just reminds me how remarkable human beings are. Yes. I think actually at one level, we need to recognize AI is not intelligent. It isn't. AI is basically a very sophisticated way of gathering and collating data. But any intelligence in AI has been provided by the human beings who've created the system, established the algorithms, it developed it. But basically what it does is it draws from the well of human knowledge and just brings things together from that. It's basically a data collection system that is cleverly organized. But
I think a techie might push you on that. We'll come back to that another time. But I think there's a bit more to it.
It was John Lennox who I remember saying it's not intelligent.
He's quite intelligent.
And it certainly doesn't have consciousness.
No.
It certainly doesn't have emotions and feelings. It's not a person in that sense. And at one level, it is remarkable that human beings have been able to create this. And yet we remain, as far as we are aware, those who have genuine consciousness and intelligence. And that is a reminder of the fact that we are those uniquely created in the image of God. It's rather like the sort of claims in evolutionists and scientists, you know, we can make life in a test tube, but actually you can't. And similarly, you know, we can create artificial intelligence. Well, it's not. There is something remarkable and unique about human beings that continues to be the case. And I think we mustn't lose sight of that. Actually, this remarkable biblical claim that we are created in the image of God. And in a sense, where does our intelligence come from? Where does our consciousness come from? How do we explain that? So to me, I think you look at AI, it's like other technology. It is remarkable that human beings are capable of doing this. And in some ways, actually, that's what God created us to be able to do, to bring the world that he'd made into fruitful progress, technology, arts, music. We are remarkable. Even in comparison to AI, it's faster in lots and lots of regards, but we still continue to be remarkable. And that is because we are made in the image of God. And I think we mustn't lose sight of that.
Or as we sometimes say to one another in the office, it's better to lick the skin of a banana than the elbow of a gorilla.
We've all been saying it. Brothers, that brings us to a conclusion. Thank you so much for commenting on all that's been going on in the news this past couple of weeks. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do rate or leave a review so others can find it. And we will look forward to speaking to you again in a couple of weeks. Enjoy Poland, brothers.
Thank you.
Thank you.